Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm here. It's time for the show. All right, email, you better have some good news for me here. What the hell? I guess it is Friday. I better look at that later. I don't know. I can't seem to get a hold of nobody. I got Mitchell Prothero. He's reporting from Erbil in Kurdistan. If I can get somebody on the phone from Kurdistan, I ought to be able to get a bunch of people from the East Coast. That's my personal belief and opinion. Hey, people I invited, email me back, please. That goes for you, and you. Oh, Doug already said he can't. But the rest of you, at least tell me no, damn it. You're driving me crazy. I'm trying to do a radio show here. It would help if I had some people to interview. All right, well, anyway. I'm going to drink some Dr. Pepper now. I'm feeling a little better. All right, well, it's the show. Prothero. You know, the problem with Prothero is the subject matter. That's the problem with Prothero. He's a reporter. He's not, purely libertarian on any of these things or whatever, but I don't require that. I just require good reporting. And the thing about him is, he does a good job reporting on what's going on over there with the Islamic State. And it's what's going on with the Islamic State that's the problem. His latest piece, actually, much of it focuses on the new video that the Caliphate put out, their new propaganda video. I watched it last night on LiveLeak. I wish now I'd spent, part of this time of the terror war years learning at least a little bit of Arabic or something. There's no English subtitles on the version I found anyway. So I don't know what all the hell they're talking about the whole time, but just shows them killing a lot of people, shows footage from their different battles and sermons and statements. And it's really ridiculous the way it has, their Islamic State logo. It, zooms in and out and spins like old Superman or Wonder Woman segues from old, superhero TV shows. You know what I mean? Or, a spinning newspaper from some movie where they have a little montage of newspaper headlines being made. It's really cheesy and lame. It's like watching Mexican TV where they're just getting into, early 80s style pop music or whatever. You're just shaking your head. Anyway, and it also shows them executing a lot of people to death. Oh, yeah. I know to death is included in the definition of the term executing people, but still. Yeah, there's a lot of death and destruction. A lot of blowing up of Shiite and Christian and other shrines and... Anyway, of course, I want to know what you want to know. What's the relative power of this Islamic State versus all of their neighbors and the actual Sunnis that they're ruling over? Just how well are they doing? And back to the problematic problem part, my understanding is they're doing pretty well. They haven't had a single major setback yet that I've heard of. Mitchell Prothero to join us on the show later, and somebody even quoted me on Twitter this morning from the Nancy Youssef interview yesterday where I was saying, I can't believe it. You're telling me the American people and even the American government are so reasonable and anti-war now that they're not going to reinvade Libya? They're not going to put boots on the ground and train up a whole army and build a democratic nation state and all the crap? And not only are they not doing that, but they're not going to invade Iraq? Now, see, this is the part I can't get my head around. And I'm not saying I'm for it. But I don't see... It's sort of like when I knew George Bush was going to run for president back in 1998. And I was saying, well, look, once he's the president, he'll have to go to war with Iraq. Otherwise, he'll be taking the risk of, being a one-term president and leaving office after only 4 years with Saddam Hussein still in power, just like his father. And there's a 0% chance that's happening at all. So it's as easy as hell to see from 3 years before he's sworn in. George W. Bush is going to be the president, and he's going to be a war president. Saddam Hussein is going to go. There's that whole faction of Republicans. I didn't really know them as the neocons yet. They were. I just didn't know that much about them. There's that whole faction of Republican hawks always saying we should have gone all the way to Baghdad, and et cetera, et cetera. It was so obvious. Same kind of thing here. George Bush and Barack Obama have turned all of George Bush's lies about the, and even Dick Cheney's lie about Iraq being the geographical center of where these Islamist terrorist movements originate. It was not true then. It is true now. And I don't know, man. I'm using my imagination, and I just can't figure the American state is going to let there be the Islamic State in what was formerly known as Iraq and Syria. And I know they don't have a partner in Maliki. They don't really have a partner in the Kurds, even, as far as the Kurds being willing to, what, you know, conquer all of the Sunni lands and keep ISIS out, that kind of thing. No. You know, we can trust them to invite us to help them protect their own border, maybe. But to go and wage the fight for us, anything like that? Nope. America's been working de facto with ISIS against Assad all this time. There's no way they're going to turn on a dime and start backing Assad against ISIS. Turks aren't going to do it. Egyptians, Saudis, Jordanians, and Maliki, none of them can do it. There are no real partners for working with there. And so there's the U.S. Army. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just wrong. Maybe I've learned the wrong lesson after all these years of war that, oh my God, it's just going to be like this forever and there's nothing we can do to stop it. Maybe is it really true that the sentiment here in our American democracy is that we don't want to have a war over there anymore and so we won't? Even if their leader is calling himself the Caliph? And even if his guys really are bin Ladenite in every single way other than the fact that they're no longer loyal to the actual orders of Ayman al-Zawahiri? You know, I sure would like to see the war not happen. I think it'll only, I think they're already coming this way anyway, probably. And I think that going to war over there will only guarantee it. And yet, what's stopping them? I think it actually could be. In fact, was this Prothero's article or was it Coburn? What'd I read? Nope, it wasn't Prothero's article. Was it Coburn? Let me see this. There's this great quote here in one of these Iraq articles I was reading. Let me see. Nope, it wasn't Coburn. It wasn't. Over 5,000 killed across Iraq in July, by the way. It was the headline from antiwar.com. One of these quotes, I'm sorry, man, I lost. I don't remember where I found it. Oh, I know what it was. It was a thing in the BBC all about the Islamic State. This isn't the right link, though. This is the right link. It's the guy from, I admit it, he's from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, but he's done a pretty good job. On writing about this stuff, Aaron Zellin. No, that's not the right article. Well, I was reading a lot of Iraq articles lately, damn it. Where's the article? I'm trying to find the exact quote for you. I can tell you what it was. It was something along the lines of, and so the American Pentagon's position is, forget it, we're not going back there. okay, wasn't either of the BBC articles either? For crying out loud. Maybe it was the last Prothero one I was reading. Anyway, I don't know. So far, I'm pleasantly surprised at the hesitance, even of the American establishment, to go back to Iraq, but I don't think it's going to hold. That's all I'm trying to say. Sorry to be such a pessimist. But Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm gonna get to Gaza here in just a sec. A couple more notes of housekeeping here. First of all, Dan McAdams just emailed back. He is going to be on the show today to talk about Ukraine. That's Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. I'll be coming up here in just a little while. And then also, let me tell you about my website. It's scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. You can join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. Got a nice little group of people in there this morning. Hey, guys. scotthorton.org/chat. You can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Retweet me, god dang it. At Scott Horton Show. And, and you can donate, or you can contact me about advertising on the show at scotthorton.org/donate. And now, I guess it's kind of an Austin thing. I know it's not really morally wrong, but it feels slimy and weird to me, and I don't really like it. It'd be easier if I could just, you know, charge a price and then collect the price for the cost of the show, but that's not the racket I'm in. The racket I'm in is I give the show away, and then, you know, maybe you donate, pay at the door, do what you can. Many of you have signed up for monthly donations of $5, $10, $20, some even more than that, and those monthly donations, they help so much. You have no idea how much that helps, you know, get through the monthly budget here. Well, there is no monthly budget. It's the skin of my teeth, obviously. Anyway, so everyone who donates on those monthly subscriptions, I really appreciate it very much. Again, I feel like there's something wrong with doing my whole NPR donate shtick. I know what I really should do is work really hard on doing money bombs and fundraising all the time, and I could get Greg Palast on here to just talk for half an hour about why you ought to support the show. He loves doing stuff like that, and I should try to beat you over the head with that kind of thing all the time, but I'd rather talk about the damn news. I just hate this stuff. But you know what? Like, what can I say, man? I got tax stamps for two different windshields that need updating. I'm going to have insurance for at least 1 month in order to even get the tax stamps updated. My license is still suspended in California from when I lived there 3 years ago for not paying tickets there. I need money. I need money. I need y'all to donate. Call it a money bomb. Call it a fund drive. Call it a Scott Horton acting like National Public Radio. Now, here, the National Public Radio, they're talking about, well, you know, we're brought to you by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and by the Pew Charitable Trust and the Robert C. Johnson Foundation. And you guys need money from me? Look, I'm sponsored by the FFF, and I'm embarrassed to tell you how little I'm charging them, okay? I need you guys to advertise on this show. I need you guys to donate for the show to continue. Simple as that. I ain't trying to be pathetic and beg or nothing like that. I'm just telling you the facts of the world. The other day, I did a 10-minute infomercial kind of thing with my newest sponsor, Darren Marion from Darren's Coffee. And even that feels like I'm doing something wrong, even though there's nothing wrong with that at all. That's the cost of doing business. He's paying for me to try to get you people to buy coffee from darrenscoffee.com, two R's, darrenscoffee.com. And so that's part of the deal. I'll interview you on the show. And it ain't selling out because it's not like I'm interviewing people from the American Enterprise Institute and pretending that I don't hate their sorry guts for the price of money or something like that. I believe in everything I'm associated with on this show, from the Liberty Radio Network to the Council for the National Interest, the Future Freedom Foundation, all the way to the Go-Kart Galaxy and Darren's Coffee and Roberts and Roberts Brokerage. And, of course, Mike Swanson's great Wall Street Window and his great book, The War State. All these things are things that I'm into anyway. Drinking coffee in the morning? Yeah. So, you know, I used to think, man, Tony Hawk, I can't believe you're such a sellout. You've already made so much money off of the video games and stuff. Do you really need to sell Bagel Bites, man? Come on, have a little self-respect for crying out loud. And, you know, back in the 80s, I always was a Hawk guy more than a Hosoi guy. I mean, I liked Hosoi too, but still, I was a Hawk guy, you know? But I thought, man, Bagel Bites? But then I saw him actually being interviewed one time, and he goes, look, man, I eat Bagel Bites, okay? I love Bagel Bites. And in fact, I'm a skater, and I love Bagel Bites too. I was raised on Bagel Bites. And so, they're little pizzas, little frozen bagel pizzas. And he said, so, you're damn right I'll take their money to advertise Bagel Bites. I got them in my freezer right now. You want some? They're awesome. And so, really, he's not selling out. He needs that money for, you know, spending on stuff that he wants to spend it on. So, you could see how it would be. Now, then again, when he's putting his name on scooters and bicycles and stuff all over Toys R Us, that, yeah, that might be pushing it there, Tony. I mean, you do the world's greatest Japan Airs and everything, but still. Anyway, point is, even Bill Hicks sold tickets to his show. You know, Mr. Doing Business is like a turd falling into my drink. He's the one who brainwashed me into whatever. I'm an ideological libertarian, and yet still on a personal basis, I'm an anti-capitalist. I just can't stand to, like, charge things, ask people for things. It's stupid and wrong. So, there you go. This is my business. I do radio. I complain about foreign policy all the time, but I need money in order to continue showing up here every day. So, if you're into the show, do what you can to support. ScottHorton.org/donate. If you have a business, if you have a nonprofit, if you have an organization, if it's something that you think that maybe I could help you guys out by talking about it on the show, then email me. You would have no idea how reasonable my rates are for advertising on this show. And I would way rather have all advertising and not have to ask for donations at all. The only reason I ask for donations, which again makes me feel icky no matter how really okay it is, if I only do it because I absolutely have to. And if I didn't absolutely have to, then I wouldn't. So the more advertisers I get, the less NPR-style begging I do on the show, and then that's better for your psyche and for mine, and everybody's happy. So, Scott@ScottHorton.org if you want to advertise. And, hey man, think of the great company you'll be in. LibertyStickers.com, the Future Freedom Foundation, Council for the National Interest, Darren's Coffee, Wall Street Window. Did I already say Wall Street Window? Wall Street Window, Wall Street Window, Wall Street Window, Wall Street Window, and The War State, Mike Swanson's great book, The War State. As well as Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc., which is where you go when you need to buy gold. You're saying to yourself, man, I need to buy some gold. You go to Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's RRBI.co. RRBI.co. And anyway, so yeah, you could also be an advertiser on the show if you want. Okay, am I done yet? I think I'm done talking about that. Oh, you know what? There's one more great way that you guys can help support the show. And I know for a fact there have been some people who have really made it a point to do this. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And that is going to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Or just clicking the Amazon logo from the front page on my site and doing your Amazon shopping through ScottHorton.org. That amounts to a few hundred bucks a month. It really helps out a lot. So thank you very much to everybody going that route too. All right. Bad news here in just a sec.
So you're a libertarian and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. That worked pretty well. My email's got a few donations in there. Thank you guys very much. I'm going to make it worth your while right now. I got Mitchell Prothero on the line. He's reporting from Erbil in Kurdistan, the nation formerly known as Iraq, for McClatchy Newspapers. And his latest, you can find it at McClatchyDC.com, or if you get stuck behind the paywall, which is a new thing of theirs, unfortunately, head over to the Miami Herald, MiamiHerald.com. You can read all the McClatchy stuff there, too. Islamic State's brutal videos send message to friend and foe alike. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. I really appreciate you joining us here. And I went and found the whole video after reading your article last night on LiveLeak and watched it. Unfortunately, I don't speak any Arabic, so I didn't understand much of what they were saying. But I'm pretty sure I did understand what I was looking at there. Sure is a brutal message, no doubt about that. Before I ask you to tell us that story, let me just start with the big headline here. From antiwar.com this morning, Margaret Griffiths has been keeping track of Iraqi casualties for about a decade straight now, and her brand new report is out. Over 5,000 killed across Iraq in July, and I happen to know that that is her conservative lowball estimate when she's compiling all these things. She tries to be very, very careful about what gets credited and counted or not. If she credited everybody's claims of how many people they killed or how many people theirs were killed in every case, it would be a much, much higher number. But anyway, it's apparently at least 5,000 killed just in the last month there. And so, well, I guess so. My first question should be, does that sound about right to you, or more or less? What do you think?
Well, it's incredibly hard to tell. I mean, it's I'd call it a reasonable number.
Yeah.
Part of the problem with the situation in Iraq for all of us is that, you know, neither side really wants us on the battlefield or had to have access to the civilians, to the areas that are, you know, contested. The Iraqi government has done nothing but lie, at least since I've been here. I think it's each day they've liberated Tikrit, which still remains firmly in, you know, ISIS hands. And again, the Islamic State has shown a, you know, profound unfriendliness to Western journalists over the last year or so we've been dealing with them. That I'm not really inclined to deal with them one-on-one. Right. So we just really can't get to large swaths of the country. But yeah, I wouldn't call that number outrageous at all. I'd probably have to, you know, go through a methodology. But I mean, alone on soldiers, I'd have to say, and from what I can tell, it's most of the killing has been limited to combatants, or, you know, what we're seeing a rise of right now are what we call, you know, Shiite sort of death squads. Going after people in the Sunni community in Baghdad and some of the surrounding areas and just summarily executing them. You know, they might be insurgents or supporters of ISIS, or they might not be. There's no real clear process on, you know, how those guys ended up dead.
Now, is that Badr and Sadr, or that's others too?
Yeah, it's going to be a whole mix of those guys. Sadr's people have been relatively quiet compared to some of the other groups, but yeah, I mean, just, you know, there's been nonstop reports. I think Human Rights Watch just came out with a pretty interesting one in which they tracked, you know, hundreds of just, you know, people in the last 6 months who've gone missing in majority Sunni areas as part of the crackdown that we'd say against the Islamic State. And, you know, knowing what I know about, you know, Maliki, the Iraqi security services, and just the way things roll in Iraq in general, you know, a large number of those people are going to be sort of caught in the crossfire, have the wrong ID cards at the wrong checkpoint at the wrong time, or, you know, even have a house somebody in the neighborhood coveted, for all I know. I mean, right. There's a lot of ways to die in this country.
Yeah, you know, Dar Jamail is talking with some of his contacts in Sunni neighborhoods in Baghdad, and they said they're as terrified or more than 2006. 2007, the very worst days of the Civil War. They know that, you know, their days are numbered. They've been warned. Some of their people have already been killed.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one thing that we noticed with great irony during that time, and I to a certain extent covered it back then, was, you know, in the earliest days of the American occupation here, it was the Sunnis who first sort of rejected the Americans' presence. They started fighting them out in the Al-Anbar, Fallujah, you know, up through the areas we're hearing now, like Samarra, Tikrit, and even in parts of Baghdad. And the whole time you were thinking, you guys don't kind of get that 60% of the country wants to kill you. You're going to really be happy about those American soldiers, you know, at some point. And by about 2007, it had dawned on the Sunni community that the Americans were the only reasons why they weren't being genocided. And it actually broke down. I remember knowing that Iraq had completely inverted itself when the most hardcore Sunni militant neighborhood in Baghdad, the place called Adamiya, which today is what we'd call pretty restive as well, at one point rejected Iraqi police from entering into the neighborhood at all unless they were accompanied by U.S. troops. And at that point, you thought, well, you know, down is up, up is down, cats are varying dogs. I mean, you know, the Sunnis aren't going to, you know, they're not going to let Iraqis in unless American troops are with them. Well, the bad news with this situation is there aren't any American troops. There aren't going to be any. And, you know, so right now I'd be absolutely terrified if I was a normal law-abiding Sunni living in one of those areas.
Yeah. Well, we could spend the whole rest of the show talking about American politics about this if you let me, Mitchell, but so I won't. Tell me about this video and tell me what you learned from this new 36-minute video. People can find it at liveleak.com. Let me see. The quote here is, "Islamic State in action."
Yeah. Well, first off, I don't want to be seen as encouraging people to go watch it because it's really just, you know, some horrible, horrible stuff. And, you know, there's a joke in journalism. We watch this stuff so you don't have to. But I guess you've taken a look at it. It's the stuff nightmares are made of.
It's ugly, just, man.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I'm getting a little old for having to I've been watching videos like this off and on for 10 years now. After a while, it starts to bore you a little bit. It's just awful the way that, you know, you become numb to this sort of violence. But what we're seeing is, unlike back in the day, in the founding group, you know, this is the Islamic State derives from what we call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Abu Musab Zarqawi group that, you know, started off in various incarnations and, you know, the early in the American occupation. They sort of were one of the first proponents of these sort of, you know, videotape yourself sawing off somebody's head style things in order to shock and outrage people. But they were just kind of a bunch of, at the time at least the foreigners were just sort of a bunch of psychopaths and school shooters. And so they didn't really have an overarching ethos behind what they were attempting to do other than just chop dudes' heads off and videotape and terrify everybody. What I'm seeing now with the Islamic State is, and they're certainly, you know, absolutely brutal people, but there's a little bit more thought going in behind it now. And what I concluded in watching this latest video and talking to a lot of analysts that I respect on this stuff, is we all sort of came to the same conclusion, which is that they're carefully targeting this violence. When they're killing people in these spectacular, disgusting, even almost factory farming style ways, like, you know, if you watched part of it, you felt like you were watching industrial killing. They're targeting people that aren't going to, they're automatically going to be hated by the people they're trying to reach, which is the mainstream Sunni community. These people, whether they're in Syria or Iraq, already hate the regime soldiers. So there's not going to be much disgust or, you know, sympathy for these guys as they're getting smoked. So there's very little political cost to the Islamic State to do this. The upside for them is, you know, a multitude of things, one of which is just people are psychologically terrified of them. If you get caught by these guys, you're going to suffer some of the worst deaths imaginable. Or, you know, there's very little chance of you getting let go. At best, you're going to get shot in the head. And, you know, it's absolutely terrifying if you're an Iraqi policeman or an Iraqi soldier. They've been setting you up psychologically now for a couple of years to the point that if you hear these guys are coming, you might decide to run for it. And that be a very reasonable, you know, point of view. That's one. The other thing that we're getting from this is it's a bit of a warning to people. Like, look at what we can get away with. We can kill 1,200 soldiers. We are the power now.
Right. All right. Well, we'll have to pick that up on the other side of this break. Sorry about that. It's Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers reporting from Erbil, Kurdistan. Islamic State's brutal videos send message to friend and foe alike is the headline at McClatchyDC.com and MiamiHerald.com. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. But they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers. He's reporting from Erbil in Kurdistan. And his latest piece is about the latest Islamic State propaganda video on the path of the prophets. And when we were interrupted by the commercials there, the point you're making, Mitchell, I think, was there's really two goals here. One, to tell the choir, look at how tough we are. We're not going anywhere. No one can defeat us. And to tell their enemies, you better run because you don't want to get caught by us, which is really, it's a force multiplier, right? The terror that they instill even in the armed soldiers of the Iraqi government.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it just it starts giving you the hinks a little bit when you've seen enough of this. The third thing, though, that I found really interesting was, and analysts had argued this, is there was an original thing that Zarqawi had wanted to do way back in 2003, 4, 5, when he would do these spectacular car bombings directed at the Shia, was he thought it would be a good idea. It was his plan to basically goad the Shia into starting a sectarian civil war that then would launch Iraq into anarchy. He succeeded in doing that. He just didn't realize he couldn't win that. Even with the U.S. sort of trying to keep the bloodshed down to a minimum or whatever. I mean, that's a long,
complicated... Well, I mean, the Americans had already thrown in with the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party by then.
To a certain extent, but they certainly didn't let them run as amok as those guys would have liked to. You know, I mean, they're just... But anyway, that's a whole show. You know, that's a whole other area, you know. But anyway, what he didn't realize was that there was no way for him to actually win that. The Islamic State's doing the same thing right now, but in essence, they're goading these Shia militias into committing atrocities against the Sunni public, like we were talking about, how terrified one might be to be a Sunni right now, and in particularly Baghdad. Shia death squads do appear to be operating, grabbing military-aged males and other type of, you know, just about anybody off the street and disappearing them. And then, you know, as a response to that, then the Islamic State can turn around and say to the Sunni community, we are your protector. Unlike Zarqawi, they can be. And so that's a powerful motivation as well. It's a very cynical one in which they're intentionally goading their enemy into killing, you know, civilians that are their own people, Sunnis, in order to make the point that they're necessary. So it's just some really sophisticated messaging that they're doing here. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Zarqawi was never really able to do, which was protect the Sunni community from the Shia. And that's one of the things that ended up making the Sunni tribes that are now on the side of ISIS, you know, flip on him at the time and start the Sabah and the Awakening Councils, mm-hmm. and, you know, help the, you know, basically the thing that the surge took credit for, the turning of most of the insurgents against the insurgency because, you know, America bought them off. Well, there's no America to buy them off this time. These guys have their own space and are able to protect their own populations. So what the Islamic State's doing is sort of repeating a failed strategy in a situation in which it might very well win. At this stage, it's very difficult to see Maliki turning the Sunnis against the Islamic State, mm-hmm. because his own militias are out there killing them. And there's no one to protect these people. Of course you're going to end up going with the power. I think Charles Lister from the Brookings Institute said this in my story. You know, I quoted him saying, you know, at this point, people are looking around going, all right, fine, I'll go with the winner who's going to provide me with security.
Right. Well, and, you know, back then they were fighting for Baghdad and they lost Baghdad. Was a big part of what led to the awakening was the Sunni tribe said, thanks a lot for provoking the civil war and losing us the capital city, jerk, to Zarqawi. Right. But now, it's a whole different question about provoking the Shia into leaving Shia territory and to coming and fighting them in Sunni territory, right? They can provoke as much as they want there, and they don't really have anything much to lose.
Well, just every time, like we saw this last week, you know, in a response which you could tie directly to some of these videos, some Shia militias have done a couple of actually crazy things. But one of the things that we saw last week was, you know, they killed 15 guys. No idea who these guys are. They probably were with the Islamic State or at least one of the other, you know, militant groups that are fighting against the government. You know, caught them, executed them, and hung them from lampposts, essentially from electricity posts, all throughout town square, like decorated with 15 dead bodies, mm-hmm. sitting there as a warning to the community. Well, those pictures didn't exactly make the Shia look any better than the ISIS guys. You know, this is the type of response that the Islamic State wants to provoke from these Shia militias, who, you know, I know some of them personally. They're extremely hard, ruthless men, and are more than willing to you know, match you atrocity with atrocity.
Right. Well, that's how terrorism works. This is what a couple of good analysts I knew right after September 11th tried to say at the top of their lungs. The action is in the reaction. They're trying to get us to overdo it. So what we're supposed to do is not overdo it. We're supposed to act really smart and surgical, not go and get away with as much as we can. They're trying to get us to get away with as much as we can. But anyway, so now 13 years of not listening to Will Grigg, here we are. Well, and now, so you talk about in your article, too, how they really learned the lesson. Another lesson that they learned from Zarqawi is to not let there be a bunch of rivals waiting to turn on them if the time comes. And they're going around and arresting and eliminating tribal leaders that could end up doing another awakening-style betrayal.
Well, they, to a certain extent, I mean, that stuff I think is being a little overhyped right now in the sense that it's something, you know, most people, and I'd say reasonably, anticipated happening as opposed to it actually having happened so far. We have seen some clashes between the tribes and ISIS or the Islamic State. We've seen a few instances of this stuff, but it's all been pretty small when you consider, you know, this is a pretty huge area they control, and it's full of a lot of restive, opinionated tribal sheikhs. There hasn't been a lot. People have been, for the most part, as one analyst said to me the other day, you know, to a certain extent, this did restore Sunni honor, restored a certain sense of Sunni dignity and control over their own destiny. And so for the most part, even people uncomfortable with the Islamic State have been willing to go along with it to see how it plays out. The only question is, once they decide it doesn't work, and I do think a lot of people will eventually get to that, you know, how are they going to be able to be in a position to stop it? Will the momentum have already taken on its own power? And can you at that point turn on them? And what I would argue is, and this is something that I'm working on for next week, it's going to be very difficult for Sunni tribes with each week or month as this goes on or these other groups to change their mind and decide to oppose ISIS. A lot of the factors that were on the ground in 2006, 2007, that allowed them to make that decision and eventually kick these guys out, they're not there now. Namely, you know, suitcases of cash from the CIA are not coming. And the other one that I think people underrated as an important part of the surge was that the tribal sheikhs themselves had American military bases in the neighborhoods to go to work out of on cell phone, where they were safe and couldn't be assassinated while they rallied their guys and cleared out the neighborhoods. Well, there are no bases for them to hide on right now. If they want to oppose ISIS, they've got to do it from their house. And eventually somebody's just going to, you know, throw a suicide bomber in their front yard and kill them. It's just, you know, it's just an incredibly different situation. And I think that some of these Sunni tribal leaders, some of which I've talked to, are playing a very cynical and very dangerous game where, like everyone else, they're underestimating the long-term determination that we're seeing from the Islamic State to be around a year or two from now. You know, I'm not saying they definitely will be. I'm just saying you can't underestimate how much thought by serious men has gone into this. When you, you know, see these videos, you think they're just savages. Well, they might be savages, but they're very thoughtful, very smart savages, and they've got a plan.
Yeah, well, that's always the biggest mistake you can make, is to assume that your enemies are stupid just because you can't understand what language they're speaking or something like that, which seems to be a big part of American policymakers' problem.
Well, actually, to a certain extent, I've seen from the Americans are starting to treat it with some sophistication. I mean, Bush was notorious for basically doing everything bin Laden ever wanted him to do. I'd say, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel is a perfect example of a tough leader who seems just absolutely intent on doing exactly what his enemy wants him to do. You know, I've studied a little bit of warfare and strategy in my day. And, you know, one aspect of war is you try to do things your enemy doesn't want you to do. Like blow up all of Gaza, you know, like it just, but you know, I will give the Obama administration some credit. It doesn't always seem like they've got a coherent policy, but one thing that is clear to me is that at least these guys have been around the block long enough that they're not easily drawn in to stupid situations. And one of them is, I think they're just watching Iraq right now. The rest of the world, and certainly the Iraqis, are incredibly frustrated with how long they're taking. Because I don't know that they can see where they'd make a difference. I've had a U.S. intelligence official tell me on background in the last month, we're not going to help Iraq because it wouldn't matter if we did. Like, the Iraqi government as it stands now can't be saved. We can't come in and fix it. So we're not going to bother. We've got to wait for something else to change before we can start adding the influence that we can add with money and equipment and, you know, whatever, you know, support, drones. You know, these are all cards that the U.S. government can play. Right now, they do not seem inclined to play any of them because they don't think in the current environment it'll make a difference one way or another. And, you know, after 8 years of George Bush, I'm not the world's biggest fan of the Obama administration's foreign policies, but I will say at least some ruthless thoughtfulness is a welcome change over, you know, what we would have seen probably from the Bush administration by now.
Yeah. Hey, even if they're just afraid to do it, I'll take that too, you know? Yeah, whatever kind of reluctance, whatever could slow them down. But now, so the opposite of that, though, is the pile of successes since the fall of Mosul and, you know, since before, obviously, but they've moved, the Islamic State has moved its forces in some number back into Syria, and they're consolidating their gains there, put a bunch of beheaded skulls up on pikes and all that, just like into Crete, over there in what's now, I guess, Western Islamic State. Province.
Well, that's the capital. Yeah, Raqqa. Raqqa's the capital. Raqqa's been the capital since last year. Right. This is the capital of the Islamic Emirate.
And so now, have they had, has the Islamic State had a major setback since the fall of Mosul at all?
No. No. Some people would argue that they took over the Shahr gas field in western Syria, in Hama province. And killed, I think, the reports were really high, like killed like 300 Syrian soldiers in one day, took over a natural gas field. And then the next day or two, you know, day or two later, the regime came back out and said, okay, we retook it from them in heavy fighting. I don't know the exact details, but my impression had been that they went in, they killed everybody, they knew they couldn't hold it, they blew it up, and then they left. Mm. And that's about the closest thing to a major setback I've seen them have since Mosul fell. One thing I would say is that they've also been very careful to not overreach. They had an initial string of success, and some of us wondered if they were going to go too far and push their luck. And what I've got to tell you right now is whatever, they're planning something else, and I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But it's my guess, if I just had to pick something off of a map, I would say look for them to expand as far as they can into Sunni-majority areas of Syria, like the city of Aleppo, which right now is held by rebels, under siege by the regime. I would not be surprised to see, you know, the Islamic State roll in and attack both in an effort to take over that city, because on paper, at least, that city is something they could hold. They don't seem interested in going after places they can't hold, namely further into the south of Iraq, where then you're dealing with, you know, millions of Shiite tribe members who, even if they don't have very much training, all have guns and are willing to die to keep you out.
Right.
They haven't shown much appetite for storming into those areas. They're being very careful not to overextend themselves and to consolidate what they've taken. So I, you know, right now we're in a lull where we're kind of waiting to see what the next move is. Another coherent move would be maybe not to take Baghdad, but to simply gut the center of it and absolutely terrify everybody and prove once and for all there is no central Iraqi government. That would also be something that could be on deck.
I forgot who I was reading who was emphasizing how many howitzers that ISIS has now, that they could just shell Baghdad for months.
Well, that's me. And I wrote that. And the main thing is those howitzers are, you know, those cannons are basically, you know, from 20 kilometers out, 12 to 15 miles at least away, even if you don't aim them particularly well, you can shut down airports with those
things.
Yeah,
that was you.
Yeah, so the question is, you know, what do they want now? You know, they could
This was a question back a month ago. We were talking about, are they going to try to take Baghdad or not? And I think, you know, like you're saying, that's answered, that they are too smart. We were wondering whether they were going to be smart or stupid, and it sounds like you keep reporting that they keep proving that they're choosing smart. But let me ask you about Mao Zedong then, because when I interviewed your friend, I forget her name, who wrote that great thing at Politico magazine about Nusra and ISIS and the whole history there in Syria. What's her name again?
Rania Abu Zaid.
Yes, exactly. Rania Abu Zaid. And she was talking about how Nusra learned the lesson from Zarqawi's failures much better, that don't go cutting everybody's heads off and don't go suicide bombing. You know, children, which I think they really did do some of that anyway. But she was saying, I guess, relatively speaking, at least Nusra, they let David Enders go, right? They kidnapped him and let him go. They're nicer to the locals than old Zarqawi's group ever was. But she also says that ISIS had kind of refused to learn this lesson, and they were still much more comparable to Zarqawi than to the Nusra guys in Syria. Only wonder how true that still holds now, post fall of Mosul and all that.
Well, this is what we're waiting to see, how well that it holds. You know, I was talking about Nusra the other day, and I agreed with Rania, and I think her article was amazing. But there was something funny. I think we were all waiting to see, like, well, maybe if the Al-Qaeda-type guys moderate themselves a little bit, they'll become, more influential and more powerful. And one thing that, you know, it reminded me of while I was watching Nusra fall apart and ISIS take over is that old American cliche about how what's in the center of the road, was it lane change signs and road kill.
Right.
And basically it was like they tried to split the difference between being a jihadi and being mainstream, and they didn't satisfy either side, and thus got made irrelevant. And, somehow by adhering to this hard line and sticking to their principles, in some ways ISIS has made itself more powerful. And that's probably a whole nother show on how you could explain that. But one of them would be just the appeal to foreign fighters, discipline within their own ranks, and I just say at the top end, leadership with a long-term plan.
Right.
If these same guys who ran ISIS ran Nusra, we would probably be seeing Nusra being successful right now. You can't replace, high-end competence when it comes to tactical and strategic thinking. And that's clearly something these guys are winning at right now. And I think the Syrian regime, who just lost, I believe, 1,200 soldiers to them in the last week, after thinking for the longest time, these guys won't bother us. They're too busy fighting in Iraq. They're too busy fighting the other, rebel groups. We've gotten away with this. Well, they're learning right now, you just can't play around with these guys. When they draw their focus on you, you lose lots of guys and a lot of land quick. It's not good. It's very hard to see anybody in the region with the military capability to take them on right now.
Well, maybe Iran, but they would have to really commit to it.
Even so, I mean, Iran's had a military that's like, it's big, I guess, but it's been under sanctions for 30 years. The Iranians have a lot of very well-trained, what we call special forces types guys, light infantry type guys. They work well with Hezbollah. They're certainly tough operators. But in terms of being the type of army that can bring 35,000 guys as an armored division, and move them and have the logistics, Iran's never had to do that, maybe in its history, for all I know, or at least since the Iran-Iraq War. And in that, they weren't particularly successful. And then you draw on the fact that if Iran does that, and enters into Sunni areas of Iraq with that type of force, that openly, mm-hmm. you could light the whole Middle East on fire, because then it brings everybody's claim of a sectarian Sunni-Shia war and all of the Persian domination and colonialism of the Arab stuff back to light. You'd probably see even more jihadis flood in from all around the world, and even half the Arab countries might end up declaring war on behalf of ISIS at this stage, because you simply couldn't allow the Persians to come in and conquer Arab land. It's a mess.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Mitchell. I sure appreciate it.
No problem. I'm glad to just always be so cheerful whenever you have me on the show.
It's good stuff, man. It's important journalism that you're doing here. I really do appreciate a lot.
All right. Thanks for having me, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers. You can find him also at the Miami Herald. Hey, and here we are back again. Break's over. Welcome back to the show. So I kept recording all the way through the top of the hour break there with Mitchell Prothero for you. The whole thing will be in the archives at scotthorton.org later on. I know it's a sloppy way to do radio, but it would have been rude for me to ask him to hang on for 9 minutes like I do you guys at the top of every hour. To hang on and finish up the interview in this segment, so... Ah, what the hell. I kept him over a little. I kept recording, and you can hear the whole thing later on at scotthorton.org/interviews. No KPFK show this week because it's a fun drive they're doing. That's why there was no KPFK show last Sunday either. But so that's nice, because usually, well, I mean, I still work 7 days a week, but having to record a show on Saturday and then still work all day Sunday on antiwar.com stuff and all that, it's a little much. So I'm happy to take a little break from KPFK for a week or two. But I'll be back with that as soon as I can for you. And yet, so now here's the part that I did not really get into depth too much with him. You know what? You may not have heard this. This may have been during the break. Did you hear this part, chat room guys? Tell me if you heard this part where Prothero says, he says he talked to CIA, or he said an intelligence officer on background who said, we're not going to fight for Iraq because there ain't no Iraq worth fighting for, or something like that. Meaning the Maliki government isn't worth fighting for. And until there is a major change in the situation over there, we're just not doing it. And he also reported, of course, a couple of weeks ago, they are building up a so-called secret base in Kurdistan. So they are building up the presence there somewhat. But I don't know. It's like I was telling my friend Corky the other day. I'm standing here beside myself. That was my favorite line from the movie Short Circuit, which I loved when I was a little kid because I was a little kid. And that was the funniest thing that anyone said in that entire movie. And I always think of that whenever I'm just beside myself. I'm standing here beside myself. I just can't figure it out. We're really not going to bomb Iraq? I mean, come on. We've been bombing Iraq for 25 years. We're going to stop bombing them now? Yeah. Or at least, and he was saying, you know, these Obama guys, they seem like they're calm and reasonable and patient, and they're a little too wise at this point. He didn't say wise, but they've been around the block enough now that they know better than to just react and get sucked into some giant thing. Cool, I guess. I just can't bear to believe it because I just can't believe it. Anyone in the imperial court knows better than to do something about anything. It's amazing to me. I mean, they'd be right to want to not intervene. But could it really be real that they don't want to intervene? And look at it from a political legacy point of view, because that's what really counts for the President of the United States, personally, is himself. That's the calculus, as all the wannabe new speakers in the Imperial Court call it. That's the basic arithmetic that the President has to do. Will people like me more if I bomb Iraq, or will they like me less if I bomb Iraq? Well, what if the situation in Iraq is really, really, really bad and I can convince people that the smoking gun will be a mushroom cloud if we don't attack? What if then? Will they like me more then? I don't know. It's just like I says back in 2006. I says I finally figured out George Bush's foreign policy. He's just trying to discredit foreign interventionism forever. I applaud him for it. It's too bad he's got to kill a million innocent people to do it. But there you go. No one will ever believe in this madness again. We're going to let you do this again. But I guess it's just, to me, it's too good to be true. And my dad raised me to never believe in anything that's too good to be true. There's no such thing as too good to be true. That's why it's called too good to be true. Now, of course, I'm oversimplifying anyway. America's been backing and bankrolling the Mujahideen in Syria all along, and we all know it. It's not like they have a hands-off policy here. They've been backing Maliki, too. But compared to full-scale carpet bombing and sending in the Marine Corps, I mean, I have to tell you, like, I don't know. Maybe it's me. Maybe I've just got some cul-de-sac of neurons just caked with resin and it just won't quit firing and it just is wrong. But I keep thinking that America is going to go to war against the Islamic State. You know, if you were listening to the same Mitchell Prothero interview I was listening to, they're going to be around if America doesn't go to war with them. And I just can't understand how American politics could allow for that possibility. Again, I'm not trying to cheerlead a war here. I'm sorry. I don't mean to sound like it. I'm trying to convince myself to believe that, yeah, We all agree, the American people, the Pentagon, the spies, the president, everybody except Bill Kristol agrees. Let's not do it. I want to just lead the cheer, man. I want to, but I'm just not feeling it. There's something else. There's another shoe waiting to drop. And I got a bad feeling about this like Han Solo, man. I just can't shake it. I mean, you're really going to have the Baghdadi in the black cloak up there, the self-identified caliph of Osama bin Laden stan, and continuing to swear vengeance upon the Americans and everybody else, too, in his weekly sermons. The bogus, ridiculous, fake Islamo-fascist caliphate that George Bush always pretended was real come to life in real life. The American national security state is going to let that stand. Now, we'll compare it, for example, to turning all the land from Iraq to Basra over to the Iranian-backed factions. That was one of those where they just were, grin and bear it. Oops. The war did not exactly turn out like we hoped, and we really wanted the Badr guys to prefer us to Iran, but I guess that was never meant to be, and so, okay, back some Mujahideen against them. That makes sense, but George Bush even didn't start the whole war over again against the Shiite South to undo his mistake. He went ahead and completed his mistake. His mistake in judgment, don't get me wrong, it was a premeditated mass murder plot, and he's absolutely as guilty as Mao Zedong or any human has ever been of any crime. But I just mean he did it based on a bunch of stupid assumptions and presumptions about how it was going to work out. But even he resorted to covert action against his own chosen people and isolating them in a certain way. From the rest of American foreign policy, turning Mujahideen against them where it was necessary. But he didn't start the whole war over again against them. But what I'm saying is, compare the consequence, though, of having Maliki and the Dawa party friends with Iran, controlling all the land between Baghdad and Basra. Compare that to the Islamic State destroying what even ever was Iraq and aligning with the entire eastern half of Syria, basically, in a whole new country. And I know there are people who say that the U.S. wanted this all along and all that. Well, maybe, but I don't think they wanted it to be Osama bin Laden jihadistan. And you know what? Did we talk about this on the show yesterday? The American Syrian suicide bomber, the American that went over there and did a suicide attack for ISIS, had come home for a couple of months, back to Florida for a little while, before he went and did his suicide attack over there. I did talk about this yesterday. I'm so paranoid about this, I can't stand it. There are going to be terrorist attacks. I mean, this guy, Baghdadi, is insane if he does not send every Western passport holding Mujahideen he's got toward us to bait the Republicans and the Democrats into further intervening over there. They're headed this way, and the FBI can't stop them. The CIA can't stop them. All the national police of Western Europe cannot filter out every single one of these guys from coming home or getting over here on our student visa or whatever. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. It's the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And, it's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. That means opposition. And so there's a lot to talk about Gaza. I mean, I guess, you know, what's most important to say is that the 72-hour peace ceasefire lasted for 90 minutes. And an Israeli soldier was captured, and a bunch of Gazans got bombed. 64 killed. What is it, 60? 40 killed. I'm losing count of who was killed where. Many were killed near the Rafah border crossing in attacks by the Israelis there. 50 more Palestinians slain in the few short hours since Israel announced the ceasefire called off, reports Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. And so there's a lot to talk about, but I think I want to stay on the... Where I think I'm useful is debunking, really, rather than reporting, you know, details of what's actually happening today and yesterday or whatever, but debunking the larger narrative. Someone on Twitter, I got an argument. I shouldn't have picked a fight. I should have just ignored it. But I picked a fight with a pro-Israel person on Twitter this morning. And he said his pro-Israel positions, and then I debunked them completely. And then, so somebody tweeted, wow, you know, look, here, Scott Horton completely debunks, not this guy, but Israel's entire narrative in three tweets. Which was true. And so I thought, well, you know, I mean, I guess that's probably the thing I should focus on the show then. Let me tell you what's not right about the big picture story that the Israelis sell. And I'm sorry, guys, for the regular listeners, for the educated. I'm not trying to be patronizing. I'm not trying to be a broken record. I'm just trying to focus on what I think is the most important misunderstandings that America has about this situation. Israeli propaganda. It's not that it's that sophisticated, but it's unrelenting in its quantity. So sometimes we have to kind of scratch the needle off the record and set things straight a little bit here. Okay, so Israel is not surrounded by enemies. The Palestinians are surrounded by the Israelis. Now, you can zoom out if you want, but if you zoom out, what you find is a loyal British sock puppet Hashemite kingdom in Jordan to the east. A loyal sock puppet military dictatorship backed by the United States to the south. A Syria that is completely bogged down fighting American Mujahideen, American-backed Mujahideen there, and Saudi-backed Mujahideen there, because that's what Israel wanted. Because they hate the Syrian government and Hezbollah even more than Al-Qaeda types, because I guess they don't really fear Al-Qaeda types, and because Syria and Hezbollah are backed by Iran. And so, as Michael Oren says, from the Israeli point of view, they are the worst threat. So America has gone along with, you know, the Saudis have their own interests as well. They hate the Muslim Brotherhood and the Assad government both, so they've been backing their al-Sham and so-called FSA movements in Syria, which all the money and guns have gone to Nusra and ISIS, as I've been and as journalists have been reporting to you on the show for the last 3 years straight. Anyway, so Israel has Hezbollah, which is a militia. Yes, Iran-backed, but still it's a militia, not a state. And with no kind of offensive capability whatsoever to their north. They now have, as they've proven in 2006, they have the ability to beat the Israelis back. But that does not amount to the ability to invade the north. But anyway, and then so the rest of the region, Iraq, of course, is in complete chaos. If ISIS has the ability to reach Israel ever, it'll only be because Bush listened to Sharon and did that regime change in the first place. The current prime minister's mentor, Ariel Sharon, back in 2003. But right now, they don't have anything like the ability to get past Jordan and Syria to Israel anyway. And, of course, the Shiites from Baghdad to Basra and George Bush's stand there, they don't have any avowed real enmity toward Israel or any real interest in attacking Israel at all. And they have plenty of their own problems, Maliki and his government, I mean. and of course, the Saudi kingdom and the entire Gulf Cooperation Council, the entire Arabian Peninsula and Kuwait too, they're all cool with Israel. They'll have the same policy as Israel does on all this stuff. And I guess people say that Qatar gets out of line a little bit and sends some money to Hamas now and then, whatever. Bah. So, it's just not true that Israel's surrounded by enemies unless you just don't actually know anything at all about the Middle East. And therefore, you just have in your imagination a bunch of sand with a bunch of sand people on it, and they're all coming for the Israeli Jews, and who's ever going to stop their horrible juggernaut of pain and death and genocidal intent? But it just isn't true. And in fact, all the governments for decades now, 15 years now, at least in the case of Saudi Arabia, have been willing to outright recognize Israel completely officially inside 1967 borders. And that goes for the PLO in 1988 and even Hamas starting in at least 2008, but I think even before that, but certainly in 2008, they had declared outright, and I believe in documents and everything else, that yes, they are willing to recognize. This was not just on Charlie Rose. I brought it up on Charlie Rose because I'm saying that's when I saw these guys explain it myself. But yes, and just go look it up. I mean, Hamas has officially said that they would recognize Israel within 1967 borders. That's why Benjamin Netanyahu added the extra requirement. Now you have to call it a Jewish state, too, which means endorsing a system of Jim Crow discrimination inside 67 borders Israel against the Arab Christians and Muslims who live there, who are second-class citizens and are forbidden from marrying Jews and are forbidden from owning and renting property in certain places, etc., etc., like blacks in the Jim Crow South before Martin Luther King came. Get it? And so that was where Hamas says, oh, now that you move the goalpost, that's a bridge too far. We're not going to declare it a Jewish state, but big deal. You declare it a Jewish state if you want. But we're saying, yes, we recognize Israel's right to exist within 67 borders. So not only is it not the position of every Arab state that they all hate Israel, want to destroy it, it's not even the position of Hamas. It's not even the position of the Palestinian Authority, any part of it. Maybe the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade or Islamic Jihad, but nobody's heard from them. They don't have any power. You can rely on Hamas to keep them down in order to move forward on the two-state solution. That's what they said. These myths that the Palestinians are coming for the Israelis, it's just the other way around. Simple as that. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up is Dan McAdams. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity at ronpaulinstitute.org and was Ron Paul's foreign policy advisor in his congressional office for a great many years. Thank goodness for that. Welcome back to the show. Dan, how are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, sure thing. Very happy to have you here. And it's nice. I think I'm glad I remembered to say that. I think people will enjoy thinking back on all of the great Ron Paul speeches from the floor of the House of Representatives that they've seen over the years on American foreign policy. And it's good for them to know that you're a major influence behind, at least not that you guide his principles. He knows what he's doing, but you certainly deserve a lot of credit for making sure that he knew what was important and what was going on every day.
I was just honored to work for him for so long, you know, and times like this with the world just seemingly going up in smoke, I sort of miss him down on the floor giving speeches, making sense of it all.
Man, yeah, you're telling me too.
But he's reaching a lot more people now with his new Voices of Liberty and everything. So He's still making those speeches everywhere.
I wonder if, assuming the media, you know, gave any kind of fair shake to these sorts of issues and questions in history, I wonder whether if the people could have 2008 back, whether they would support Ron Paul, whether it's, I guess, it's not like TV has been reminding them that Ron Paul was right about all this stuff back then and we all refused to listen or anything like that, but if you think about all the stuff he was warning about and all the foreign policy, warnings of why we should quit and all the terrible things that could and would happen from all the intervention we'd already done and whatever, it seems like the American people have finally now come to Ron Paul's position just a few years too late is all.
Well, sure. If you look at recent polls about how people feel about intervening in Ukraine and how people feel about the U.S. empire, you know, the numbers are striking that people are so opposed to it, especially when you consider the mainstream media, how it shoves it down their throat constantly. You know, somebody's got a splinter in Sri Lanka and we have to send in the military.
Right. Well, and, you know, I think back on that and I just think, man, it's so sad that the bubble didn't pop in September of 2007 instead of 2008, right after Ron finally stepped down out of the primaries and let the chieftains battle it out and all that. Right after it was too late, the bubble finally popped and proved that his warnings had been right about the economy all the time. But can you just imagine if starting from about, you know, just a few months after Giuliani made him famous, the bubble had popped then and he was able to explain why from the entire presidential campaign as his bully pulpit? Oh my God. He'd be the president right now, and there'd be a lot more peace in the world, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, well, it's fun to think about that, but, you know, if witnessing the blatant stealing of votes that he experienced in the 2012 campaign,
yeah,
the cynic in me says there's no way they would let him win anyway. I mean, it was just so obvious how they were stealing the votes away from him.
Right. I actually got the book on that, but like the rest, it's sitting in the pile. I haven't gotten to it yet, but I remember in real time as it happened, there were people blogging and counting the states, and it was, I don't know, a dozen, two dozen, maybe more, where the dirty tricks were just unreal.
Yeah. It's hard to get too excited about voting when that is something that happens all the time.
Right. Oh, well, at least you got the chance to be the best parliamentarian in the history of humanity, so that's pretty good, dude.
Yeah, it's not bad.
All right. So now, let's talk about the horse show that is Ukraine. You can tell I'm stalling, man. I'm so burnt out. It's Friday, and I'm sick of all the killing this week. Tell me about what's going on in East Ukraine. What's the state of the battle for Donetsk, and what's the state of the proposed ceasefires and negotiations? Let me have it.
You know, it's funny. I'm getting ready to try to write something today, you know, and the thought that keeps crossing my mind is how strange it is that nobody's really talking about Ukraine. Obviously, Gaza is first in a lot of people's minds because it's so right out there in front of us. But it's interesting how the U.S. government seems to have just dropped Ukraine. You know, it had this first feeble attempt to release these very grainy, inconclusive satellite photos. Who knows what they showed? And then that's it. It's strange. It's
well, you know, actually, I got one exception to that, Dan, which was Barbara Starr, the Pentagon spokesperson, posing as a CNN reporter, accusing the Ukrainian government, the Kiev government, of using what they were, you know, classifying as out of bounds medium range ballistic missiles with 1,000-pound warheads on them, and saying, "Hey, these can't help but cause indiscriminate casualties and." This was a scandalous thing, as reported by the Pentagon on CNN. I was kind of surprised about that.
Yeah, that is interesting. And it obviously, you know, it's funny because the U.S. mantra is de-escalation, de-escalation. But, you know, that's only for one side. But this is an enormous escalation. As you right. point out, half-ton payloads that these bombs can carry, and I think they can go around up to 600 miles. These are massive, massive bombs that are so indiscriminate. If that's not escalation, I don't know what is. But, you know, and I know you like to read this blog, and I do too. The Moonovac Alabama blog pointed out that if they were able to detect these launches over Ukraine, them meaning the Pentagon and the spooks, then certainly they would have had the ability, they would have had a satellite that was looking over Ukraine 24/7. They would have had the capability. They would have the evidence about this Buk launch against the aircraft, the MH17 right. aircraft. So it's interesting that on one hand they say we're detecting these launches of these medium range missiles, but when it comes to the other, they're simply providing nothing.
Right. In fact, well, you know, we got a couple of minutes before the break here, and let's talk more about the war on the other side of the break, and let's stick with the plane here for a second. I think I told you before, Dan, the Occam's razor was that the rebels must have shot it down accidentally. They've been being bombed by Kiev from the air, and it makes sense that they screwed up. Maybe they can fire a missile. But, boy, that case has really fallen apart, and it really is starting to, I'll be honest and say, seem to me, like, really, maybe the more likely explanation is that the Kiev government shot the plane down, and even on purpose. Is that what you think?
You know, I'm feeling that way, too. I was like you at first, thinking, gosh, you know, it sounds like, at the least, it's a terrible accident, whoever did it, and this sort of thing. But so many things that keep hitting me in the head that cause me to have doubts about this. What's interesting is, you know, the first OSCE inspector to reach the site is a Ukrainian-Canadian, Michael Bocherku. And he did an amazing interview on Canadian television, CBC, where he said, they said, you know, well, what were the first things you saw when you arrived? And he said, there were two or three pieces of fuselage that were pockmarked. He said, it almost looks like machine gun fire, very strong machine gun fire. And then the interviewer said, well, did you find any examples of missile? He said, we're asked, did we find any examples of any missiles? And he said, no, we haven't. So it is interesting. And then you see other evidence that certainly people are claiming, and the Russians pointed this out too in their briefing, that there was a Ukrainian Sukhoi fighter jet that had been trailing the plane, and that this was somewhat common practice for them to hide behind these passenger jets. So it's very interesting to think about all these different theories that seem to be cropping up. And in the meantime, the U.S. is saying nothing.
Yeah. Well, and all importantly here, there was that huge climb down that they did where they called, this was last week, of course, where they called all the different pool reporters together, I guess, the intelligence beat reporters, and climbed down on, you know, all of their major assertions and just said, we don't know.
It's also interesting, too, and I don't have it in front of me, but I did note with some interest that the initial headlines out of places like the, I want to say, AP and Reuters were basically what had happened, which is the U.S. intelligence community saying we don't have anything. And then they changed the headlines very quickly to a much more ambiguous and nuanced position shortly thereafter.
All right, hold it right there. We got to take this stupid break. We'll be right back with the great Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dan McAdams. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Yeah, those things have to go together. You get it? All right, yeah. So we're talking about what's going on in East Ukraine. It's hard to always, it's like Star Wars, you know, you're always starting in the middle of a story. You never really find out about the battle that took place right before they got the plans to the Death Star, you know. So here we are, never mind last fall, and never mind last February, and never mind anything else. Now we're at the beginning of August 2014, and so now what we really need to know is, what is the state of the battle for Donetsk in the east, which has declared itself not quite completely independent, but at least autonomous and outside the rule of Kiev for the time being. And there's been a pretty big fight going on there. What can you tell us about the state of the battle and of the proposed ceasefire? Because the American politicians, of course, at least have been talking about winding this thing down, maybe, Dan?
Well, they've been talking about it, and so has the Ukrainian government. But what they say when they come over here to the U.S. and what they do when they get back home are often very different things. You know, there was a press conference between Kerry and the foreign minister of Ukraine a couple of days ago, and it was very interesting what Foreign Minister Klimkin said, which just, I mean, it just doesn't comport with reality. He says, the Russians are firing over the border at us all the time. Their helicopters are in our airspace, but we have never fired back, of course, in order not to provoke the situation. And first, because we're committed to international law. So we never fired back, you know. And so I guess the Russians must have shelled their own border crossings, you know. Well, what's interesting is for all of the U.S. claims, you know, beyond the airplane, the U.S., the big thing is sort of the big let's change the subject for the U.S. last week when they trotted out Marie Harf, their spokesman, was, well, Russia is just getting ready to send over a bunch of heavy weaponry over to Ukraine. We know it's going to happen. And of course, the great reporter Matt Lee from AP said, well, how do you know? And she said, well, can't tell you, social media. But then the UN, Nari Pillay was just said yesterday that the UN has no hard evidence of Russian transfer of any weapons over to Ukraine. So they
You're right that they made a huge story out of what was about to happen, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Huge. They made a huge story and they captured the headlines.
Yep.
You know, one of the wonderful things about being down here in Texas, Scott, is that I'm right next door to Dr. Paul's studio. And during the break, he popped his head into the office and we were talking a little bit about what you and I are talking about now. And he said, you know, with these sanctions, it's really funny. The justification for the new round of sanctions all goes back to the early claims that Russia shot down the airplane. And nobody thinks about it now because they just assume that Russia did it because that's what the media pounded in those first few days. But all the new sanctions we're seeing now are all based on something that, as you said earlier, is really flimsy, if not falling apart.
And that they've even climbed down from and said, you know, we really should have been more specific before.
Yeah, but have some sanctions anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Your morning
sanctions. And so, but now the Germans are saying, here, let's try again. Here's another... You know, a deal. Jason Ditz had a good article about this. We talked with him yesterday about they really had tried to take everybody's objections into account on this thing. You could tell it was a real good faith effort of the Germans to put this thing to bed. You think, and I guess Wolf Blitzer is claiming now, so maybe that's how we know it's not true. I don't know, but Wolf Blitzer is saying that Obama and Putin just got off the phone. So
yeah, I saw the Kremlin readout of the call. And it said they both agreed that the situation is in neither of countries' interests as it stands now. But of course, that doesn't really tell us much about the specifics, you know. But the German plan, I think, is yet another indication that the Europeans are nervous. I think they're bullied by the U.S. into following blindly this sort of crazed State Department that it just doesn't seem real to me. But I think they are nervous, and you're seeing, can you imagine the city of London, how it feels if it will be all of a sudden, it'll be cut off from doing business with Russia? I mean, it's just insane. So I think they're trying to do these things without the U.S. involvement, and one can only speculate that the U.S. comes back and is furious and tells them to stop doing it.
Right. Yeah, that's the maddening thing. You know, the same thing happened with, June 30th or whatever, where the Germans tried to make peace and the Americans told Kiev, don't listen to them, keep pushing.
Yeah, and they've gone along, but guess what? You know, their economies are not in very good shape. Ours are getting rapidly in worse shape. If you look at the debt and if you look at the you know, the expansion of military. The U.S. has now announced that it's sending, I think, was it $8 million more dollars to help the Ukrainian border guards and these sorts of things. So, reality is biting hard, I think.
Yep. All right. Now, I guess Jason was saying that one of the Americans had a competing plan before, but it required the Russians leaving Crimea. Yeah. Right. That's not even a poison pill. That's just, you know, a stick of dynamite tape to the damn deal. Give me a break.
Yeah, it's a way to say that we've tried to do so. It's sort of like Poroshenko saying that we want a ceasefire. Meanwhile, here, have this ballistic missile.
You know,
I mean, it's very, very telling that the government of Ukraine launched a massive offensive in the area of the plane crash immediately after the. I mean, I think the plane was barely on the ground when it launched this massive offensive. And many people were killed. And these things don't just launch overnight, so it had to have been planned, I would guess. A major military offensive would have had to have been planned quite a bit in advance. Yet it started immediately after the plane crashed.
I don't know. It could be a coincidence. Back to the plane crash there. And it seems like, again, you said TV changed the subject, so that's good, but... for the excuse that they were using it for, I guess it had already served its purpose. But, you know, I guess it does make sense. Again, this is not my first assumption, and it's far from, I guess, a solid conclusion or anything, but it does make sense that the Kiev government would either shoot it down with a fighter jet or might fly a fighter bomb or something in order to bait the rebels into taking a shot, but actually tricking them into hitting some civilians for PR purposes. Governments do these things from time to time.
Sure, and it's shown itself that it's not the government in Kiev is not hesitant to take civilian lives. You know, we've seen horrific footage of bombing of old age homes, bombing of schools, just people in the middle of the town square blown up. So they're not concerned about civilian lives. So what makes it any different if the life is up in the air or on the ground? You know, it's but as you say, I mean,
they lie their ass off from the beginning too about the plane being there and about all the audio and YouTube footage that they leaked and all that stuff, right? They got caught out lying 3 or 4 times.
Completely, but they're saying what the U.S. wants them to say as well. So they have a partner in crime. It's hard not to think about the things that we've been talking about, because what they say just doesn't add up. And at least the Russians have said, we don't know. Here's what we have. We don't know. Show us what you have so we can compare notes. You know, and that's that seems fair enough to me.
Right. Well, and of course, the real truth of it is we're never going to know, because there's never going to be any kind of impartial investigation. You got different factions running off with different pieces of the damn plane, and who knows what's going on over there. So,
but of course, even us just saying this, Scott, means that we're devotees of Putin and we're over here worshiping at the statue of Putin. You know, this is the level of insanity of people that even among unfortunately libertarian circles. You know, stop defending Putin. You know, it's absurd. The day that you and I will defend any politician, except maybe a former politician that we both know, is a rare day, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, Putin to me is the worst kind of Republican. And, you know, and I'm from here. So, yeah, that does not put me on his side whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, but we know what the drumbeat to war sounds like. We've seen this movie before, and we have to struggle to fight the propaganda that leads to war. It's not enough to be anti-war. You have to be anti the propaganda that leads to war.
You know, it's funny because they lie to us. They lie us into war so much. You would think that everybody would just say, okay, lesson learned. Whatever Gulf of Tonkin scenario you're selling me, I'm not buying it. But instead, I even find myself, Dan, thinking, well, you know, in this case, it's not like they can really lie about, Casus Belli in a row. I mean, they got to be telling the truth about something at some point. But no, really, no, they're always lying. It's never true.
Exactly.
It's incredible. You know? That's how I deal with my own cognitive dissonance. I try to cut even Obama slack, and then, nah, he's a liar. Him and John Kerry, the worst. Well, thanks so much for your time, Dan. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, that's Dan McAdams, everybody. He's got a great stable of writers over there at the RonPaulInstitute.org.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The Worst State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com, or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
In international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin, destroyers of the United States Navy are assigned routine patrols from time to time. Sunday, August the 2nd, 1964, the destroyer Maddox was on such a patrol. Shortly after noon, the calm of the day is broken as general quarters sound. In a deliberate and unprovoked action, three North Vietnam PT boats unleash a torpedo attack against the Maddox.
The destroyer was carrying out a mission of patrol in those waters, in international waters. When it was attacked, it...
Man, did you realize tomorrow was the anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin? Good timing. Well, there you go. So, they sure do lie us in the war a lot. Let's see. I don't know the specific lies that they used to declare war on Britain. I know they were lying if they claimed that it was about impressment on the high seas. I don't know if there was one specific incident that served as the excuse for declaring war. I need to go back and read my Rothbard about that. They certainly lied us into war with Mexico, claiming that the Mexican troops had attacked the Americans on Texan, now American soil, when in fact it was in the disputed territory between the San Jacinto and the Rio Grande. It was the Americans who were on the other side of the line, and everybody knew it. Even Lincoln called out James K. Polk for it. So they made fun of Lincoln, called him Spotty Lincoln. Like it matters who attacked who in this war. We got the whole Southwest, shut up, they cried. Anyway, then there was the deliberate provocation at Fort Sumter. No matter what all your many different opinions on the war between the states, they could have shut down the tax collection post at Fort Sumter and negotiated. But instead, they didn't. And seems like pretty much lies into war there. Of course, the entire lie against the Plains Indian and all the Indians was they started it, which was obviously a ridiculous lie. Also backed up with, God wants us to go ahead and kill them all and take all this land for ourselves. Another kind of, I don't know if that's a fake causes belli or not. I guess so. That counts. That's as good as WMD, right? Whatever you call it. God and country, and he's a Hitler, and hey, look, a fetus, right? That's what Bill Hicks said. Yeah, I played the fetus clip for you on the show yesterday. Yeah.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
There, see, I'm skipping ahead, but anyway, so then they lied about the battleship Maine to lie us into the war with Spain. And I don't know, what was the specific lie for killing all the Filipinos? Jesus wants us to? They're Catholic, but we gotta convert them to Christianity? Something like that. I think McKinley said, well, yeah, we gotta Christianize them. Yep, they've been conquered by the Spanish for 200 years, dude. They're Catholic enough. They're Christian enough. Nope. Anyway. And then the Lusitania and the Zimmerman telegram. Are you kidding me? If there has ever been a thinner case for war on the planet, I've never heard of it. The Zimmerman telegram, where the completely blockaded and destroyed and starving Germans promised the Mexicans that they would help them invade and reconquer the southwest of the United States. Which, oh, I'm sure the Mexicans were just dying to go for that. Oh, you're going to help us retake the Southwest, huh? From where? From Germany? You're going to help us do that? What? Anyway, that was the casus belli for Woodrow Wilson, the worst person who ever lived, the father of Hitler, the father of Stalin, the father of Mao, the father of Pol Pot, the father of the Bushes. Woodrow Wilson, the worst person who ever lived, used that excuse to get us into World War One and destroy everything in the whole wide world. And then, of course, FDR tried to lie the American people into war with Germany by getting battleships sunk by German U-boats, but Hitler wouldn't fall for that one again. Not after what the Kaiser had done in sinking the Lusitania and priming everybody for the Zimmerman telegram hoax to become such a, you know, become the excuse for war. So Hitler wouldn't take the bait. So instead, FDR deliberately set about an 8-point plan. You can read the McCollum memo. It's easy to find online and read about it at antiwar.com. The 8-point plan, how to provoke Japan into attacking us first, written by Arthur McCollum, who had spent a lot of time in Japan previously before being expelled by the militarists, and knew all about just what it would take to provoke them into attacking. And as Stimson, the Secretary of War, wrote in his diary, the only question was how to maneuver them into firing the first shot. And so that was how they lied us into war there. And then, of course, Senator Vandenberg told Harry Truman about the how to get the American people on board with the Cold War, that he had to lie. Scare the hell out of them, Harry. Go out there and tell them that the Soviet Union that just lost 20 million people in their war with the German Nazis is about to conquer the entire planet Earth if we don't stop them, and how we have to have a massive Cold War to contain them, and how never mind all of Stalin's overtures about a permanent peace and drawing a line at the Iron Curtain line and all this and whatever, negotiated, what have you. Let's contain them. Let's roll them back. Let's have a Cold War. And they lied us into that, and then based on that, lied us into war with Korea, when it's completely well established that the South Koreans engaged in numerous provocations across the border with the North in order to get them to take the bait and invade the South and then bring in the Americans and the rest of the UN on their side, as they did in that war. Lie to the American people all about that. Same thing with the Gulf of Tonkin clip you just heard to get us into Vietnam. First of all, that it was anything like America's business, that it was anything other than just an American invasion of South Vietnam to prevent them from electing the people they wanted to elect. It's not just that the communists have won the election for the, or were prepared to win the election for the whole country. They would have won in just the South, too, by a landslide. Communist or not, Ho Chi Minh was determined to expel the foreigners. And so pretty much everybody was in on that other than those who were already the sock puppets of the French. And anyway, so they lied us into war there with the fake Gulf of Tonkin crisis that never even happened. Those torpedoes never even existed. It was a mistake, but McNamara and LBJ knew it. Although I think Porter says, isn't it Gareth Porter that says that McNamara hid that from LBJ? Oh, the correction just came in across the wire. He never told the president. I don't know if that's really true or what. But anyway, so then McNamara lied us into war, if not LBJ. Anyway, they did. And then, again, the whole Cold War was all based on the giant lie that the Soviet Union was going to try to militarily invade and conquer and take over the planet Earth, that there were any real threat to America other than a defensive one. But that is what a threat is, anyone who can defend themselves from America. So there's that. And they're evil communists, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying the whole premise of the Cold War was fake. That's all. Read your Rothbard. And then, of course, after Nixon had made peace, at least relative peace, with Mao and with Khrushchev and détente in the 1970s, in the Carter years, Brzezinski and then Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan, they all ratcheted the brinksmanship right back up again after Nixon and Kissinger had begun to smooth things over. And all that was based on a bunch of Team B lies that the neocons came up with about fake and, completely imaginary Soviet advances in technology and numbers and all this. The reason we can't find their massive fleet of silent submarines is just how silent they are, but not because they don't exist. And then lied us into Gulf War One after inviting Saddam to go ahead and break the Kuwaitis' kneecaps, and he just took it a little far, and then they refused to accept all Saddam's efforts to get out. And then they lied us into Iraq again. They lied us into Afghanistan by claiming the Taliban wouldn't give up Osama, lied us into Iraq again with all the weapons and ties to Osama, lied us into Libya with the fake massacre in Benghazi that was going to happen. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all. So, did you see the news? The Times of Israel published an article entitled, "When Genocide is Permissible." Oh, they've since taken it down, but guess what? People got that print screen function, so it'll live forever. So, I don't know. I guess a defender might argue, yeah, so he doesn't speak for everybody or anything, but meh. It's his policy being carried out. You know, I don't know if you can believe a CNN poll. Maybe you can, although I don't think they have much reason to fudge a poll like this. They said 95% of the people of Israel opposed a ceasefire. That was yesterday. Was it 2 days ago? I guess it could have been 2 days ago. 95%. These are the people always accusing everybody else of being collectively guilty. Damn, have you ever heard of a 95% consensus for mass murder among a population? That's crazy. I mean, everybody's an individual, and they're the people of Israel are not as responsible as the government that they're cheering. But damn, man, lighten up a little bit, guys, would you, on the bloodlust? It's ridiculous. It's completely out of control. And it goes back to what I was saying before about how the Israeli narrative just doesn't hold up here, okay? Palestine is not the country next door. Palestine already lost the war. They lost it back in 1967, the last bit of it. Gaza and the West Bank are occupied territory. No, they didn't withdraw in 2005. They just turned it from a place with some Israeli settlements on it into a maximum security prison, concentration camp. That's all they did. Again, I'm repeating myself, but I'm trying to get my point across the best I know how, so forgive me, but this isn't like even a fight between the blue coat, you know, Union Army and the Indians out on the plains. This is like a fight between the Union Army and Indians on their reservation, when they've already been captured and interred. Okay? It's a canned hunt. It's fish in a barrel. It's a bunch of virtually unarmed victims with their back to the wall and nowhere to go, being slaughtered. That's what it is. And so, what's the problem here? The problem is, from the point of view of the Israelis, that the Palestinians won't just all lay down and die. They're in the way. The Nakba of 38 that removed 750,000, maybe more than that, Palestinians from their homes and made them refugees in Syria, in the West Bank, in Jordan, in the Gaza Strip. They had to stop back then because politics. They couldn't take it all. And they've used every excuse to attack more and expand greater Israel more since. And they're always great at blaming all of their assaults on their victims. But anyway, Menachem Begin admitted that the 1967 war was started by Israel, that it was a war of choice, that they had other options, including not starting the war. But their plan is, they call, the Israelis call, and especially the right-wing nationalists, call the West Bank Judea and Samaria. They got magical real estate deeds going back 2,000 years somehow that say that eventually all those people got to drop dead, get the hell out of the way, one way or the other. Now, I think they're not as biblically concerned with taking the Gaza Strip, but still, the Gaza Strip is a pain in the ass. You know what I mean? I live in Austin, Texas. What if in order to have Austin, Texas, we had to have a ghetto of Comanche that we just had to bomb all the time because they wouldn't stop shooting bottle rockets over the wall? Forever. You know, I mean, the true history is the people who settled Austin, Texas killed all the Comanche is what they did, and so that's not a problem. Unfortunately, as the war nerd likes to complain, Hitler kind of ruined war for everybody. He sort of overdid it so bad that now war is completely and totally out of style. And that whole Lebensraum, how do you say it? Lebensraum? It means get the hell out of my way. I want to conquer your land and steal it and make it mine and populate it with my people and not yours. And that means kill you or force march you away. You know, Manifest Destiny style. That's no longer okay. And by American edict, really, in the form of the United Nations and the global law, that's banned now forevermore because of Hitler and what he did in World War II. So now it's a war crime to populate conquered territory with your own people with an intent to steal it. If borders are going to change, it should be by negotiation only. No more wars. Only America can start wars now. That's the law. Well, and I guess America's deputies. But anyway, so what's the problem with the Gaza Strip? It's full of Palestinians. That's the Israelis' point of view on it. When genocide is permissible is when you, according to the Times of Israel article, is when you've got a bunch of people who you don't want and they won't stop resisting. And, you know, I don't know, man. It sounds like a lie, but it ain't. It's a screenshot. And it's our friend Cade Crockford from the ACLU of Massachusetts. She's really great. I hope you follow her on Twitter, One Cade. She's one of these, you know, pissed off lesbian, feminist, civil rights, leftists. And she's really, really, really pissed off about violations of people's rights and war crimes and things like that. Me too. I could follow her only on Twitter and be happy, actually. But here she is, genocide as Zionist as stolen hummus. And she's RTing some other guy, Jimmy Princeton. I don't know who that is. Where's the Voxplainer for this Matt Iglesias classic? If you're not familiar, Matthew Iglesias is a prominent liberal writer on the internet and founder of Vox.com. And here's a screenshot of his blog from, oh, it is April the 1st, 2002. Although at the top it says March 31st, 2002. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it was an April Fool, but I don't think so. It's Matthew Iglesias saying maybe it would be more humane to go ahead and expel all the Arabs from the occupied territories. Sure, it would be a humanitarian disaster and it would cause another war, but Israel could win the war and then at least the occupation would be over, he wrote. That's when genocide is okay. When Israelis do it, I guess. You buying that? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, so welcome back to the show. Here's the thing that's so infuriating about the Israel-Palestine issue, too, is that, well, obviously, the American government is paying for Israel's slaughter of the Palestinians, and it helps engender terrorist attacks against the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the even more infuriating part about it than that, to me, is that it doesn't have to be this way at all. And it's true that it's completely just illogical and immoral and wrong and crazy to think that after World War II, the European Jewish refugees can just come to, well, not that they hadn't been already coming there, but anyway, that they could just come to Palestine and make their own state and expel 750,000 people and build a country of their own on the rubble of the one that was already there, etc., and get away with it. And yet, that was way back in 1948. It's a hell of a lot more than a fait accompli now. And of course, they're as well armed as France or something like that would be an equivalent country when it comes to their military capability and their budget and all that kind of thing. Western European modernized military force. And it's just been a hell of a long time. As I was saying earlier on the show, Yasser Arafat agreed to recognize Israel within 67 borders back in 1988. And so I'm not saying everything be perfect or whatever. I don't believe in anybody's utopia ever, okay? But it's so easy to imagine a counterfactual where instead of being the world's biggest jerk, the Israeli government took more of a position like Yitzhak Rabin wanted to do back in the 90s before somebody blew his head off for it. A settler. And that is that knock this off with the occupation. Give up the West Bank and Gaza. Let them have a Palestinian state. Try to move forward in peace and security and cooperation and maybe someday friendship from here, huh? Something like that. What if that had been the policy all along from, I don't know, 1975 on? Hey guys, let's go ahead and work this out. I was saying earlier, they've already got peace with Jordan. They've got peace with Egypt. They've got peace with the entire Gulf Cooperation Council. And if they had a peaceful attitude instead of one of biding their time and conquering and attempting to create greater Israel, as Benjamin Netanyahu just put it, all the way from Jordan to the sea just the other day, he said, Israel must control all security. That means the Israeli state must extend from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean forever. That means the whole West Bank belongs to them. They didn't have that attitude this whole time. If that hadn't been what they were working for this whole time, and they had just let there be a two-state solution, then, you know, things would still not be perfect, and there would still be tough negotiations over the right of return and all that. But you know what? The Palestinian leadership, as Stephen Zunis has talked about, has written about, Palestinian leadership has already negotiated away their right to return to 1967 borders Israel. They said, we will exchange that in exchange for the international community. That means everybody except Israel picking up the tab to resettle the refugees living in Syria and Jordan and whatever elsewhere, I don't know, North Africa still, to resettle in the new Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. So, you know, in other words, like I was saying, I don't really believe in utopia, but it's so easy to see how if the Israelis were anything like an honest broker in these negotiations all these years, through Oslo and road maps and Annapolis and all this, you know, John Kerry coming to town, all this crap. In fact, read the new thing in the New Republic, which, you know, it's very, very understanding to the Israeli point of view in there, but there's just no mistake about it. It's a long-form piece about the latest peace process attempt of John Kerry here and how the Israelis, rule number one is no maps. Okay, we can negotiate, but no one is allowed to have a map in the room or else the entire negotiations are canceled. Yeah, okay, thanks. And then every time that they're getting anywhere with the Palestinians, they announce huge new settlement expansions of the colonies on the West Bank, making political support for the Palestinians to keep moving forward absolutely impossible. Deliberately. And they sabotage the talks because they don't want When Netanyahu says he ever wants a Palestinian state, he's lying. What he wants is Judea and Samaria to belong to Israel. His father helped found Likud on that exact premise. All right? So, it's just so easy to see. It's true. Look, I mean, it sucks. It's not fair. I'm not justifying it. But I'm just saying the Palestinians have already said, fine. You kicked our ass. Fine. At least just let us have the West Bank and Gaza as an independent state then. Okay? We're humiliated, okay? You beat our ass, all right? Can we please just have a Palestinian state in what's left? And the Israeli answer is no. Drop dead. We'll help. For anyone in America to take, and I see evidence of this all the time, all day on Twitter and everywhere I go in the media. The only Americans who take the Israeli side in this have brains full of nonsense and a bunch of false facts and fake beliefs about who's zooming who around here and who's occupying who and for what. It's ridiculous. Oh, all Israel does is give up land and it never gets any peace for it. Huh? No. I don't know what universe you live in, but no. The Israelis have been taking and taking and taking and taking, okay? Yeah, they gave up Sinai after a while. Well, the Bible isn't so obsessed about the Sinai, I guess. But that Judea and Samaria, that belongs to, well, all right-wingers in Israel, whether secularist or not. Somehow. Yeah, all atheist Israelis believe in God all of a sudden when it comes to their magical property rights. Anyway, so, you know, I think most Americans, the reason all of our heroes in the Westerns and the Star Wars and everybody, they're all reluctant heroes, is because that's who's a hero to us, is somebody who's only forced to fight. Not a warrior who goes out seeking to conquer and destroy and whatever. No, we're a peace-loving folk, but don't mess with us. That's our creed. And we want to see that in others. We want to see it in ourselves, even when it is far from the truth. And we project that onto our friends as well. You know? But ask yourself, do you think Britain invaded virtually every nation on the planet at one point or another just because they love everybody so much? Really? Even if you like England, right? You've been there. They're our ally. They're our friends. Do we have to pretend that every decision their emperors ever made for the world were in the world's best interest and that's the only reason why? Why should we have to pretend that about our government, which in fact is not us, but is our government? We are its people, more like it. And certainly, why should we have to believe that about any other government in the world? Especially about the Israelis, who pick on their captives all damn day, like they're Nelson Rockefeller and the Gazans are the prisoners of Attica. Except that half of them are children and none of them are convicted of a damn thing. There's just no question about who's defending themselves and who's the aggressor here. If you disagree, it's because you just don't know what you're talking about. Sorry. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it. And there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So stupid, the nobody loser commander-in-chief of us all, Barack Obama, is giving his big talk about nothing right now. Something about the economy. Yeah, yeah. But so that brings up something and gives me a chance to change the subject from the three big wars going on right now.
And that is the, well, in a sense, the kind of fake debate going on in D.C. Right now about the president's powers. The Republicans don't want to impeach him. They want to sue the president for doing so much legislation by way of executive order. And, of course, the Democrats keep emphasizing that, you know, especially in working with you Republicans, there's just no time to discuss this in committee. We have got to go ahead and get the people's work done. And we need a leader who's willing to go ahead and be strong and make things happen. And if the Republicans are just going to be obstructionist about everything, well, then they're just going to, the president and his Democratic allies are just going to have to go ahead and do whatever it is that they think has to be done for the greater good of the people. And you're pretty familiar with the routine right now. Very interesting the way the Republicans are just suing over it. Passing a resolution in support of a lawsuit? What the hell is that? Let me go ahead and say it's pretty clear that Barack Obama is guilty as hell of so many felonies. Forget about it. You could indict, you could impeach, remove, indict, convict, and imprison Barack Obama in a week and a half. He just had an honest prosecutor and any real such thing as the rule of law, he'd be in the Supermax next to Ted Kaczynski and Ramzi Youssef, the other mass murderers. You know, that's not a problem coming up with felonies he's committed. Are you kidding me? He's the President of the United States. He's been killing people illegally. For how many years he's been in office now? Since January the 20th, 2009. And we see the same thing, you know, the another kind of story, another symptom of the current version of checks and balances, the current struggle between the executive branch and the legislative in this CIA spying on the Senate, Intelligence Committee, which has jurisdiction over the intelligence community of oversight to see to it that they are abiding by the law or else they don't get their money to do illegal things or whatever. Anyway, you know the theory behind it. Well, the Senate wrote up a report about the CIA's torture regime. And the CIA, of course, lied about this and lied and lied and lied. But they now admit that, yeah, they broke into the Senate Intelligence Committee staff's computers to find out what all they got, even though they were the ones who were responsible for furnishing the Senate Intelligence Community with the information they had in the first place. It's not like they just had access to all the CIA's computers. The CIA set them up. Okay, here's the information. Go through it. And then they went and spied on them to find out what all they had. Oops, did we accidentally give them too much? And then, of course, you'll remember the CIA tried to file charges with the Justice Department against the Senate staff for having documents that the Senate staff believably says the CIA gave them in the first place, that the CIA changed their mind about and decided they didn't want them to have. And this is just a small thing, really, in the scheme of things, right? But hold on a second. All things being equal, this is the scandal of the decade. Or, you know, everything, all things being equal in the right turn of phrase there. Everything else peaceful. A normal country in a normal time. A limited constitutional republic, a rule of law. You have the CIA picking on the Senate Intelligence Committee like this, illegally spying on them. And then protecting themselves by trying to file charges against their overseers? You know, we can all hold hands and hate Dianne Feinstein equally for any humongous number of reasons. But regardless of who she is, whoever is the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee,
they say jump or lay down on your belly or whatever the hell it is, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency better do as he's told. He has no authority to say no to her at all. At all. And what's happening here is the end of any precept. And really, this is Dick Cheney and David Addington's revolution here. Barack Obama hadn't done a damn thing to roll it back. He's only expanded it by killing Americans, too, and all that. But after 9/11, Dick Cheney and David Addington decided that they were going to set the precedent that they could do anything until someone finally reined them in. They were... As far as they were concerned, the Constitution said they could do anything they want. They could tell any lie they want. They could torture anyone they want. They can kill whoever they want in any country they want, CIA or military or however they feel like doing it. They can spy on all of our information in violation of the Bill of Rights. And their point wasn't even we need lies about Saddam, so torture this guy, and we want to, collect dirty pictures of Americans, so spy on those people and whatever, as much as it was setting the precedent that there is no limit to the authority of the executive in wartime, even if it's just pseudo-wartime, against terror, the emotion one tends to experience when subject to an act of terrorism, you know, the survivors. They've just gone to war against even the concept of the rule of law. You're all familiar with this, the plenary and inherent authority of the commander-in-chief to protect us, the unitary executive, blah, blah, blah. Call it whatever you want. It's dictatorship. That's what it is. It's an executive branch that has grown so far out of control. You can see when a weakling like Barack Obama is in the chair, he commands nothing. He's hardly in charge of his own government at all. Sure seems like a lot of the time, doesn't it? And that's because the executive branch of government, and particularly Jacob Hornberger sitting on my shoulder, and particularly the national security state. He makes a great Jiminy Cricket. The national security state, that post-constitutional military intelligence authoritarian police apparatus that's been set up for the American people and for the people of the world. And first in the name of the communists, and then for a little while the drug lords, and on to the terrorists, and maybe now back to Russia again. And the point is that it's just like George Lucas tries to say in Star Wars. That's where that line comes from. That's a reference to dictatorship in the first place. There's no time to discuss this in committee. In that case, Han Solo, he's the captain of the Millennium Falcon. It's his private property. It's pretty much up to him. But the point is, in times of crisis, what happens? Everybody turns to the strong leader to decide, because you know what? John Boehner, he's just an obstructionist. The Congress just can't get things done. But there are important things that need doing. And so, as Garrett Garrett wrote in Rise of Empire back in 1954, the executive branch becomes predominant. You know, historically and constitutionally, the Congress comes first. But not in the age of empire. The executive comes to the fore, and all of its cronies, and, you know, most closely intertwined with the state, with the most to lose if it ever changes its policies from a system of world domination. They tend to dominate, and you can see it right now on your local news. Even they talk about how the federal highway fund is gone, and I'm not one for federal highways. We should have state highways, or in fact, a private property anarchy, really. But I'm not necessarily for that. But that's beside the point. The point is the Congress. Why they just don't have money anymore? You guys are gonna have to figure out something else about what you're gonna do with your trucks full of food, trying to get between here and there. But they can't live up to that. Why? Because they put their empire first. And they've got more than 1,000 bases in other countries around the world. And that's the priority. That black budget that Edward Snowden leaked to Glenn Greenwald and to Barton Gellman. That extra $50 billion a year that's off the books. $50 billion. Straight off the books. That comes first. in the age of empire. And that's the world we're living in. And it's, you know, as Garrett said, no U-turns. Too late now.